Good afternoon. We have one case left on the docket to be argued this afternoon, and I understand the attorneys have checked in. Before we begin, I do want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. Thank you for being here. And since both sides are ready, I'll ask the clerk of the court to please call the case.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. We have primarily two issues for the court to consider this afternoon. One concerns whether or not the trial court was statutorily authorized to conflate the questions of whether or not to grant probation with the question of what the appropriate sentence to confinement should be in my client's case. That's a statutory challenge. The second issue that you have is whether or not the court's admitted predisposition to arrive at a particular, at the maximum amount of confinement when granting probation prior to my client's trial. And as a matter of fact, we allege, and I think the transcript bears it out, to implement a policy across the board in every case that the trial court had arrived at. To briefly recount the facts, my client was charged of a Class A DWI misdemeanor based upon a prior conviction for a DWI, so it wasn't a over .15 kind of case. She entered a plea of guilty and, with the consent of the state, went to the trial court for punishment. We've appended the passage of the trial court's decision on punishment as appended as an appendix to our opening brief.
And is that what you rely on, is what the court said on the record after the break was taken? There was a break taken during the lunch hour,
right,
and the court came back and made the announced the sentence.
Yeah, pronounced sentence, correct.
And it's that passage that you're relying on to prove that there was some kind of routine practice that was not deviated from in that county.
That's correct. And I would only modify that or qualify that by saying that the closing arguments of the parties, in this particular case, the prosecutor admitted on the record 90 days would be an appropriate punishment in this case if you do not grant community supervision. But if you're going to grant community supervision, then you need to make it the maximum so that you can punish them for any new offense they commit in the future.
Well, just because the prosecutor argued it that way doesn't necessarily mean the judge decided it that way.
And I wouldn't rely only on the trial court's or the prosecutor's argument. Mm-hmm. The court, in its statements, it's kind of hard to follow because it is kind of disjointed. But the court says,
read.
I want...
And I found it difficult to follow what the court was actually saying.
Okay.
I understand maybe there was a gist of something that was being said, but there were a lot of incomplete sentences in that.
And
I think maybe seven pages where the judge is talking.
And I understood it when I heard it, although, you had to listen. But I think reading it as a whole, not in particular parts, what the court was saying, I like to have the full range available, which it says in the record, because we've got minor offenses and then we got new offenses or minor violations and then we got new serious violations of criminal law. And that's the reason why I like to have the full amount available so that I can impose punishment taking into account the new criminal offense.
But he wasn't nearly as articulate as you were today.
Well, I I've got more hair than Judge Coode too. I don't know that either one of those things are necessarily relevant, but
what I mean by that is you are connecting all of those dots and coming up with that statement, a summary of what he said. When I look at what he said, I'm not so sure I can connect the dots and necessarily in that manner. I see that those were considerations that the court was talking about.
I don't think there's any doubt. There's no doubt in my mind. And I think if you do read it, even though it's not as articulate as the court has been kind enough to refer to the way I speak, the phrases where the court's saying, I like to have the full range available based upon what might happen in the future. That's very clear. You also have the state's argument that preceded that, and then the court referring to the state's argument. I understand about the dispute about how things should be sentenced. That's how he starts off. I understand how the sentence y'all dispute, but in this county, I like to have the full range available because they might commit a new offense, basically, in the future, and I like to have the full range available in order to impose punishment taking into account the new criminal offense in the future or the egregious, what would be.
That's the part I didn't actually hear him say.
Okay, all right. That was the gist of it. And I've sent out the statutory history. There is a lot. There's no cases directly on point either in the Court of Criminal Appeals. We have actually an opinion written by Judge Gabriel dealing with difference between speculation and inferences, predictive inferences. And then, of course, the state brought up the thing in 3707, but failed to mention the fact that prior criminal offenses, that is, extraneous offenses that a jury could consider in arriving at punishment, would only be permissibly considered if they were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. You couldn't possibly have that happen for future extraneous offenses in order to, and so I think it's a statutory interpretation thing. And of course, historically, going back to the very beginning, I did brief it, the legislative history, every adult probation or suspended sentence law, they, for most of the time, they had it separated where a jury wouldn't really know whether someone would get probation. They would just determine whether they had been sentenced to a certain amount of time. They would probably know whether or not the person would be eligible based upon the amount of sentence they gave. And then the trial court would have discretion, and the jury wouldn't even make a recommendation. Some statutes, they made a recommendation, but it wasn't binding on the trial court. The comments in Murphy versus State, although that case dealt primarily with the admissibility of extraneous offense evidence, and it was superseded later by statute, I have quoted comments in that majority opinion where they talk about the fact that the decision whether to grant probation is distinct and separate from the decision about what amount of punishment or confinement, more specifically, someone should be subjected to punish them for the offense they committed that they are on trial for. As another matter I bring up is the idea of the constitutional avoidance as a canon of statutory interpretation. If you start allowing prosecutors to argue that jurors should assess punishment based upon offenses in the future that may or may not ever occur, or as in this case, a trial court concluding that he has that statutory authority to speculate and kind of like a deferred adjudication situation. We are not claiming that if you're on deferred, you hadn't been convicted yet, you hadn't been sentenced yet, a judge could not consider the conduct that you engaged in prior to being convicted or sentenced. But the trial court in this case conflated those two things.
Let me make sure I understand. I agree you are articulate, but I walked away uncertain as to your position on this. So let me make sure I understand.
Right.
Are you saying that there is something wrong with a trial judge who just, let's take a hypothetical, not this case, a hypothetical motion to revoke where the maximum is in place, that it's inappropriate for a trial judge to give different sentences based upon what the allegations are in the motion to revoke? For example, a failure to report twice versus two new offenses.
No, I'm not. What we're talking about here is before a revocation. We know that after a revocation, courts across the country, U.S. Supreme Court, has said that it would be a double jeopardy problem if you punish the person in a revocation proceeding for the new offense. So that's the reason I'm talking about statutory interpretation. The legislature surely would not have intended that because that would create a bar to punishment for the new offense. And, of course, you wouldn't have a guilt beyond reasonable doubt.
And you couldn't be complaining about that in this case anyway.
No, and we admit it's not right, but as a matter of statutory interpretation, the legislature would have contemplated that would have created an obstacle if it was to be applied or the authority was to be granted to trial courts to do what we claim the trial court did in this case.
Or thought he might do in the future in this case.
Right. He might do in the future in this case. Or anybody else that gets probation in Wise County, they get 360, they get the maximum, whatever the punishment range is. And so the trial court is indirectly doing it. We know that this court, as well as the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, and I believe it was the Rogers case, this court's case was Weeks, or Week versus State, where you can a trial court on regular probation cannot increase the punishment from the original sentence. And that's a matter of statutory interpretation. You're supposed, when you sentence the person, you sentence them for, on the record, and for the purpose of punishing for the offense they were on trial for. And logically, there's no way to get the same concept would apply to say that a court can't indirectly get around that by just in every case sentencing everybody to the maximum, and then depending on what the violation may or may not be in the future, reduce it down from there. That's basically this, a but violation.
Can you really complain today in this case that this judge in this county is sentencing everybody to the maximum?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact,
can't you only really complain that he sentenced your client to the maximum?
Well, we've made the assertion, and as an officer of the court, I'm telling, in jury trials, the prosecutor gets to argue to the jury, you should go ahead and punish them. You don't know what offenses they're going to commit in the future, so you should give them the maximum in this case.
But once again, that's a prosecutor's argument.
Yeah, and that's right. But what I'm saying, that influences a jury's what otherwise would be a fair determination of a sentence.
But that didn't happen here.
Well,
it's
happens.
Not before us this case, right?
The state has denied our assertion and factual assertions in a brief that are
but
not
But we don't
disputed.
Have the authority to just go out and cure problems that might be out there that aren't before us.
Okay. I can only represent one defendant at
right.
a time, okay? If you only can say, if I make an allegation in a case and the state doesn't dispute it, if you don't recognize that that should be a basis to determine, of course, I'm not asking you, you're going to rule in this case. Mm-hmm. And under stare decisis, I presume that it would apply to future cases that come before you or come before the trial court. But
the facts have to be in this case for us to support that whatever ruling this court
That's right. And
makes.
And the state has not denied that in every case where someone is granted probation, in that one only criminal trial court in Wise County, the procedure followed in this case is the one, like the court said, in this county, this is the way we do it. And that's what the trial court said in the record. This is the way we do it in this county.
So it's your position that that's a violation of due process?
Well, it's violation of, it's not authorized by statute, number one. And then getting to this predisposed policy that we do it in every case, because that's, I always like to have the full range available. That's why I do it this way in this county. That would be like the Ex parte Brown case, where although it's not exactly the same in the sense that Judge Baracus was saying, if I see you again, I'm going to give you the maximum. In this case, it's still, if you're talking about harm, you're talking about the same kind of harm, is that we're showing harm because a different result, you can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that a different sentence would not have been imposed or assessed in this context had the error not occurred. And it's a constitutional, that's the Ex parte Brown theory on the due process clause, is that the court is admitting that it does that.
So in essence, what you're arguing is you've got a partial arbiter of that decision, a partial decision maker.
If you had, and I
don't, you're deprived of an impartial.
Yeah, and I make the example in my reply brief. If you were had a jury voir dire or veneer, and somebody said, if we find them guilty, If we find them guilty, we're going to give them the full amount, no matter what the facts are, because that's just the way I feel. That person would be disqualified. I wouldn't even have to use a peremptory challenge. The same thing or the same rationale should apply to a situation like this. I like Judge Coote. I just don't agree with him on this particular issue, and it is harming people out there. It's harmed my client.
Did he actually say he always does it? He does it in every case? I know he talked about the county and how he likes it.
I think if you read—
Or is it just a fair reading?
I think it's the only reading. If you read it, I mean, I was there. I understood what he's talking about, and you— combine that with the state's argument that preceded it, where it should be 90 days without probation, 365 if you're going to give him probation. He agrees with the state in making his, he's responding to my argument, all right? And you can read that by reading the closing arguments, my position, what I stated, and his response after lunch. In this county, I like to have the full range available. So
if he really was predisposed to make that decision ahead of time, why did he take a lunch break? Why didn't he just do it?
Well, maybe I was more persuasive than he could immediately come to a conclusion about.
So maybe he used his discretion.
Well, maybe he said, I've been doing the wrong thing for the last 15 years.
Let's see.
Okay. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to hear our concerns today. My name is Robert Carper, like she said. I'm the assistant county attorney, and I've been there, be 9 years in March. Okay. So I've had quite a bit of time in front of Judge Coode. Okay. So I have boiled down the appellant's complaints into three different categories. Number one, he's alleging that there was some kind of predetermined policy that he already had formulated in his mind before he entertained the punishment hearing in this case. Number two, that somehow there is some kind of legislative intent for a bifurcated punishment process in which a judge or a jury, in this case it's particularly a judge, that a judge should put on blinders to the issues of probation and or parole, and that shouldn't consider those and only consider that after they've in a vacuum decided, well, how much would I send this person to jail for, and then only then can I entertain whether or not I want to give them probation, things like that. And then number three, he alleges that there was some kind of a improper speculation in regards to future violations and or subsequent criminal offenses that may occur. Now, in regards to number one, you know, as this court knows, this court has held and the Court of Criminal Appeals has held that as long as a judgment is within the legislative range and it's based upon a factual basis, that the assessment of a judge or a jury as far as punishment is unappealable, unassailable, okay? And so this case clearly is within the prescribed range of 365 days, and the fine and the other different terms are clearly within that prescribed range.
Is that true even if the trial court goes on the record and announces that the reason for their ruling is something that, whatever it may be, is unconstitutional?
Well, that would be bringing me to my next point, the due process challenge, which is a judge.
In other words, I'm going to sentence you to this because of your race.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it still sacrosanct? Or
definitely be a due process violation, and that was bring me to my next, you know, he has kind of alleged a due process. He basically said violated due process by not giving formal notice that you've already prejudged this case, and answered that as far as you know, due process, they have to remain detached and a neutral judge. And I think in this case, if you read the record, if you read more than just what the single statement that the judge made that the appellant wants to put forth as its sole support for its position, if you read the entire record, which contains multiple pages of the judge talking about different things as far as the need for, he believed that the prior DWI case, she didn't receive probation, didn't receive the real rehabilitative measures that possibly could have alleviated the reasons why this is occurring in the first place.
Well, that would be relevant to the term of probation, the years of probation, not the term of incarceration.
Right. But if you look at the whole record, it shows that he did contemplate the full range of punishment, which is also necessary to avoid any kind of due process violations. And I think, and in this case, the appellant did not ask for findings of facts or conclusions of law. He's taken that one statement, not asking for any clarification on what that statement means. And so what we're left with is what the Soto court put forth. We only have the record to rely on. And if the record reflects that the judge did review, did consider both aggravating and mitigating facts that were presented by both sides and instituted, you know, various ranges within that punishment like the judge did here, he didn't assess the full fine. He only assessed a $500 fine. And he went into detail about why he did that, and that was because the evidence showed that put on evidence that she had some financial difficulties. Okay. He also went into, you know, why he assessed only 80 community service hours, didn't assess any jail because she put on evidence that she had medical issues. Okay. And so those kind of things show that he considered all the evidence that was presented to him and considered the full range of punishment. Okay. And so I think for those reasons, you can't just take one statement that was said by the judge, which no clarification was asked for on it, and say
isn't
that...
Isn't it kind of analogous to the case where a judge says, if I see you again, I'm going to give you the maximum, and then they do?
Well, in this case, and another thing I'd like to point out, it's not analogous because he's not imposing the sentence. He's just...
But it's saying... What I'm going to do if I see you again. This is what I'm going to do, and then he does it. In this instance, Judge Coode says, I like to have the full range. In this county, I like to have the full range, and then that's what he did. And that's how it's analogous, isn't it?
Well, no, the appellant wants to present the idea that if any violation occurs, whether it just be a technical violation, I didn't show up for a probation meeting, or if I committed a subsequent offense, another DWI, something like that, either one of those the judge is going to come down.
That was the question I asked him just a minute ago, and he said, no, that's not what he's saying. It's just a judge telling you that this is what I do in every instance. That's the problem that has been identified, and I just wonder what the difference is between those two.
Because if something does occur, it doesn't necessarily going to carry a 365-day sentence regardless of what happens. What it does is it brings it back in front of him, and he could go all the way from, okay, I don't...
You know, in advance of being given probation, I'm going to get the max. I'm going to get the max of incarceration, and then he'll decide what the term of probation is, because that's what he says he's going to do in every case. It's the same thing as saying, if I see you again, I'm going to give you the max.
But he didn't say that he does that in every case. He said, in this county, this is what I like to do. That's not what I do in every case. But if I put somebody on probation, I like to hold the entire range of punishment available to me in the future if I do so need it.
Okay, so that's the difference.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Well, okay. Issue number two, which is basically the appellant is advocating for a bifurcated punishment process, and he relies on supposedly legislative intent. And just a note on this particular instance, he's basically making two arguments, that the judge or a jury shouldn't consider issues of probation or parole while they're deliberating on what kind of sentence they want to issue. Okay, and then on a side note, he's also making an argument that prosecutors shouldn't be allowed to argue for a certain amount, like you said earlier about if you do give them probation, you should give them the maximum probation or so on and so forth. And so what the problem I have with that is it's in direct contradiction to what the conduct was during the punishment hearing. In the punishment hearing, the first person that broached the subject of probation was the appellant on direct examination. And so they're the ones that introduced that into the punishment hearing, and now they're turning around and wanting to make an argument that it's improper when they're the ones that introduced it. Okay. He obviously didn't make an objection to the prosecutor making an argument to the judge about, well, if you give him probation, you should give him the max, because the appellant was the one that introduced the issue of probation.
They have to introduce it. They have the burden to prove that they're qualified for probation. Well, so we're supposed to hold that against them?
I agree with that, but now he's making an argument that a judge or a jury shouldn't entertain the probation issue when they're the ones that introduced that issue to begin with. Okay. But, I don't rely on legislative intent. What I'm relying on is basically you can find language in 3707 that basically, especially in direct regards to if a judge is assessing punishment, that he has the option of issuing a pre-sentence investigation in which the probation department prepares a written report that the statute says basically that the judge is required to take that in consideration prior to announcing sentence. And so that, the language in itself says the probation is an issue that it should be deliberated on and is involved in developing the proper sentence for an individual. Additionally, 3707 also allows for instructions given to juries prior, by the judge prior to deliberation, and those instructions include issues on probation and parole. And so what the appellant is asking us to do is, like I said, put blindfolds on, not consider those issues which you've just been instructed on, and only give a sentence and then check the box as far as if you want to issue probation. And a judge obviously already knows all those conditions. A jury would be instructed on them. And so now you're asking them to ignore those instructions for the time being, make a decision, and then come back and entertain the instructions that were given to you. And then I don't know how that would be workable for an individual to do that. Obviously, there's case law from both this court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. I relied mostly on Ellison, which the language in Ellison basically said probation is community supervision during the punishment phase is directly relevant to developing the proper sentence, and that it's designed to take blindfolds off judges and juries to make the proper sentence. And in this case, the appellant contends that we should put the blindfolds back on and only decide one thing at one time and then come back and decide another thing, when the court has said, and this has been upheld in the Patterson case, in this court, in the Sanders case, and the Waters case, that basically this all goes in together to develop everything is relevant to come up with a proper sentence, both what the facts are and issues of probation and or parole. On the third issue, it's basically the appellant has contended that the judge improperly considered or speculated on future violations or future criminal content. And what I pointed out, what I pointed to was basically that what is the purpose of putting forth evidence in a punishment trial of somebody's criminal history of prior bad acts, even unadjudicated? You obviously have to comply with the rules of evidence and getting that evidence in front of a judge or a jury. But the purpose of that is not only possibly for a harsher punishment, but also has a predictive value as far as, if this person has five thefts, they're here on trial for theft, it's a rational or reasonable inference to conclude that there's a possibility or a probability that this person may commit another theft. Okay? And so for that purpose, it's always allowable to make reasonable inferences from the evidence that's presented as far as the probability or possibility of future violations or future criminal acts. Okay? And he's saying that's not proper to do that. Well, that's the judge, that's the judge's discretion, a jury's discretion to take that evidence and make reasonable inferences that this person may in the future possibly reoffend, another occurrence may happen. And so one of the reasons we have stiff punishments, stiff penalties, is we want to deter people, deter the public in general, but deter possibly this particular individual. And in this case, the facts bore out that it was a DWI second, but the blood results were a 0.234. Ran into a tree and ended up in somebody's front yard, was belligerent to both the homeowner and the officers that arrived on the scene. And so it'd be different if it was just pulled over. It's a DWI second, barely over the limit, something like that. But the circumstances that surround it, these were all presented to the judge. He can take that in consideration, and the fact that the first DWI was only, the conviction was 13 months removed from the offense of the second one. And so taking all these into consideration, I believe it's reasonable for the judge to believe we obviously have something going on here. There's a possibility, because these are so close proximity and the aggravating circumstances surrounding it, that a deterrence is needed in this, and what better deterrence than knowing that if I do not comply with the probation, if I do reoffend, then I have the possibility of receiving the harshest punishment available. And so I would say that would be the biggest deterrence for somebody to comply with what the sentence has been handed down.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
In the brief time I have left, I would just refer the court to the appendix in appellant's brief, page 108 of the trial record. At line 4, the court says, here's how it works. On line 7, the court says, trial court says, I like to hold this, have that available, the entire range available. And skipping down to page, or line 15, something, you know, as serious or more serious or worse or whatever offense, like a new offense, like what we call a really big violation, and that's why I want to have the 365 available. All right. I can't see it being said any clearer or any clearer support for our assertion that that's what they do in Wise County. That's what Judge Coon does in every case, not based upon the facts in our case. Now, we are not trying to persuade anybody to put blindfolds on anybody that determines someone's punishment. What we're saying is there's a difference between assessing punishment for the offense someone's on trial for and equipping someone with a looking glass or crystal ball as a component of determining someone's punishment. If you assess punishment for the first offense based upon speculation about a second offense, what you're ultimately doing is not deterring them from the second offense, you're deterring them from the third offense because you're imposing punishment on the second offense. And that's something I just don't think is statutorily authorized to do. I think to have a policy where you do that in every case has deprived my client of due process. I think under the statutes or the rules for determining harm, whether it's a constitutional violation or the statutory violation, my client's substantial rights were violated and their right and her right to a fair trial. And you cannot say beyond reasonable doubt that the outcome of the procedure would not have been different had the trial court not made the error that we're claiming it made. With regard to the question of the unreviewability of a trial court or a jury's assessment of punishment, there is a difference between questioning whether a particular offense warranted a certain amount of punishment and inquiring into whether the procedure underlying that decision is valid and legal or even constitutional. That's the error that Judge Barakas made wasn't just limited to the punishment he imposed. He committed constitutional error when he decided to sentence those people to the maximum or tell them he was going to give them the maximum at the time he placed them on probation. That was the constitutional violation, although there's actually more than one in what ended up being the revocation and fulfilling the promise. In this case, we were entitled to a fair assessment based upon, and I have no problem with people on the record making an individualized assessment in each case on what would be enough to deter someone from a second offense based upon their past criminal history. I don't think it's statutorily authorized or even constitutional to say we're going to include your punishment for this offense, the full range like you might be able to do in deferred, to deter you from committing not just the second offense, but then we can punish you on revocation to deter you from the third offense that you still have after this conviction for the sex offense or the second offense would not have been yet even prosecuted. And so I think if you read the legislative history, you're going to find that these decisions were supposed to be separate. And he talks about bifurcated. It is bifurcated. In fact, in a felony case, it's trifurcated, where a jury decides whether you've had a prior felony conviction, which in all cases you do, which would disqualify you, what the sentence should be. In felonies, it has to be less than 10 years. That's the second decision a jury or fact finder on punishment does. And then third, whether you're suitable, for lack of a better term, or deserving, or whether it's in the best interest of the community to grant probation. And by coalescing two of those factors, that is, let's give them the max if we're going to give them probation, or let's give them, like the prosecutor said, 90 days if you don't, you're proceeding outside of legislative authority. And then that policy, again, that the trial court follows is unconstitutional. Unless there's any further questions, I'm prepared to return my time to the court. You got
thank
any questions,
you.
Anybody? No? Okay, thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you for your argument. Your case has been submitted.